Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. President Obama has called for the complete removal of American troops from Afghanistan by the end of 2014. In the meantime, the U.S. is moving on to other concerns like the presidential election. But reporter Malcolm Garcia hasn't forgotten Afghanistan. He just returned from one more reporting trip there, and he'll join us in our second half today. First, public radio journalist John Hockenberry. Hockenberry is the holder of four Emmys, four Peabodys, and a whole lot of distinction for his reporting over the years in places as far-flung as Somalia, Lebanon, and Jerusalem. John has done all this despite living his life in a wheelchair as a result of a long-ago car crash. John Hockenberry is co-host of the daily news magazine, The Takeaway, and he'll be in town Friday to speak at an event for The Whole Person, a group that focuses on people with disabilities. And John Hockenberry joins us now from WNYC Studios in New York. John, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
It's great to talk to you, Steve. Happy afternoon. I guess afternoon here in New York, still morning there for you.
You're ahead of us as always, John, which is the natural order of things, I think. Yeah.
Right. There you go.
You've been in the radio business for a whole bunch of years. Are you surprised that radio appears as vital today, John, as it was, you know, back in the early 80s? Because a lot of people thought radio had a death sentence attached to it for a long time.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of very interesting currents in radio. I mean, I think technology has been very, very disruptive. And I think both in the preparation and the way we do our jobs, you know, how you actually produce pieces, how you record the digital technology has made it much easier, I think, to do the kind of radio reporting that public radio is known for. And I think in some ways, radio, public radio is a kind of a pre-internet podcast. And so there's something very intuitive about the immersive quality of radio that lends itself very much, and nobody understood this until the audience kind of pointed us to this. It lends itself to time-shifted podcast. People like the programming immersive experience of public radio. And I think the internet, that's exactly what the internet does. And so in many ways, we're fueling each other. I think radio fuels the podcast world. I mean, for the longest time, the top 10 podcasts were public radio and sports. It's changed now. It's proliferated now. But, I mean, in the very beginning, I think we were the real pioneers in podcast audiences. That's not to say that there's a lot of really sophisticated, savvy people in public radio riding the leading edge of this. I think there are now. But I think we very much were spectators. It was the audience that showed us that we are much more akin to the internet than we are cannibalized and being, victims of predation from the internet, unlike, you know, television and some other media platforms.
Well, do you think public radio can survive and work with this immersive quality, or are we just moving too fast these days to see a future for that kind of journalism and that kind of experience for listeners?
Well, I think it's bigger than journalism. I think public radio is both a social network and an immersive platform for journalism content. And it's not just journalism. I mean, Prairie Home Companion is not journalism. And I think This American Life is journalism, but that's just a piece of what This American Life is. Their narrative, you know, Radio Lab the same. I think these are narrative programs that are very, very immersive. But they also exist within a social network. And I think public radio is this perfect fusion of a social network and immersive programming. And, you know, I think we didn't really understand what we had until the internet came. And I think the audience really pointed the way. So, I don't know why it's a bright future, but I'm not going to question it. I think the real problems in public media are monetization, maintaining the pledge drive model. Is that going to work? It's a subscription model, but I think it's very, very difficult to shift to something fundamentally different. Some stations are doing better than others. And I think in the nonprofit world, there are going to be really huge struggles as the sort of excess capacity in American capitalism begins to shrink, because I think the whole prosperity model is shrinking. We're going to have to do more with less everywhere in our society. And I think the levels of excess income and excess capital that supported the nonprofit world traditionally, I think are not going to be there in the ways that we've traditionally relied on.
We're visiting with public radio journalist John Hockenberry. Your show, John, The Takeaway, is a magazine show, you know, much like Morning Edition. In fact, you go head-to-head with Morning Edition. How is your show different?
Well, I think we're not a magazine. We don't think of ourselves as a magazine. I think the show has evolved to be more segmented in the last year or so. But I think in general, we want to be a live conversation. I mean, we definitely want to take what the headlines are and what the information is that you may have heard on Morning Edition or another public radio program and really take it into the place where people are talking about it and how they're talking about it. So, for instance, Paul Ryan is named vice presidential candidate with Mitt Romney. I mean, yes, the magazine shows will do the bios and where did he come from, and let's look at the budget, the Paul Ryan budget. For us, it's a question of what do voters think about the possibility that Ryan is going to be saying some really tough things about entitlements and that the strategy of Mitt Romney suddenly shifts to look a lot more like Mondale Ferraro in 1984.
Yeah, no kid.
Where Mondale and Ferraro were saying very tough things in the middle of the Reagan Revolution. And it didn't turn out terribly well for Mondale Ferraro, but American voters have a tough time listening to tough reality, whether it's fiscal reality or tax reality or interest rate reality.
Is that changing?
And I don't know if it is changing. I think this is going to be a real test.
Yeah.
Carter discovered that you couldn't necessarily talk. I mean, if you talked realistically about what was going on in inflation back in the 1980s, Ronald Reagan handed you, it's morning in America and we need to be optimistic. And Americans gravitated towards the Reagan message. And they did it in 84 again. And so the question is, can Romney mobilize a kind of crisis mentality and maintain that sort of centrist optimism? And I don't think it's necessarily any kind of a slam dunk.
Did the pick surprise you?
It didn't really. I mean, I thought that ultimately, and I don't know anything, and I'm not a pundit with much of a track record, let me tell you that right off the top. My sense was that Pawlenty and Portman from Ohio would just ultimately, at the end of the day, seem much more like Romney himself.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A little bland, mm-hmm. a little regular. And so they needed something that was not a nonlinear choice like a Condi Rice, who I think he should have gone for, but someone not nonlinear, but with a certain amount of risk associated with him. And Paul Ryan is really the only guy. He's definitely got the Tea Party creds, and he is risky in a certain sense. But at the end of the day, he looks a lot like Romney. And so, you know, them standing up there, they make a dynamic duo that's, you know, the anti-McCain-Palin, that's for sure.
What role, going back to your program, what role does your digital presence play? You know, I'm talking about The Takeaway's website, its podcasts, and social media like Twitter and Facebook. What are you guys doing on all those fronts?
For us, I think the question is very simple. We want to launch conversations, and we want to extend conversations, and we want to use the internet as a way of essentially booking our listeners on the program, not in a live call-in context, because there are tons of people doing that. We're not interested in listeners as callers. We are interested in listeners as idea generators. And we really worked very, very hard and made, you know, tons of mistakes. And I think you're not getting anywhere on the internet unless you are, you know, running the risk of making some mistakes. And so I think what we've really learned is that if we listen to the audience, they will be a good guide for us, and that our program will feel interactive, not because it has a lot of bells and whistles either online or on the air, but because the audience understands that we are listening to them, and if they give us good ideas, they will hear them on the air. And that, I think, has been very exciting for us.
Why did you make that change away from the traditional model, which is, you know, caller-driven talk shows, people call in and comment on the day's topic? Why did you make the switch?
Because I think what works for us is, you know, the kind of individual data points that ideas represent. So, you know, you don't have to talk for a long time with a caller to get their essential idea.
Yeah.
When we hear the callers, and it's amazing, because if you listen to call-in radio, a lot of times the callers who are on, and it varies from show to show, but in general, there's a kind of sloppiness to the callers on talk radio. They sort of have an idea and they're going to rant here and there and that sort of thing. And that's nothing to disrespect them, but it's just the ideas tend to be really sharp. Mm-hmm. And what we want is the sharpness of the listeners, and we're not necessarily interested in learning a whole lot more about them. Now, occasionally we will get, and it's not more than occasionally, I mean, we regularly get stories from listeners, and that's really what we're asking for almost all the time. We get stories from listeners that are spectacular, that are amazing, and then you do bring them on and go, tell us more about that. Hmm. What happened? Yep. Why did you call us? Why did you share that? Those kinds of things with a lot of high emotional content. But I think for us, it's the idea that begins the conversation. You know, it's like at the water cooler. If somebody's monopolizing the conversation, it's kind of dead. And so you want to keep it moving around. Like, you know, I need to shut up now and listen to you. Kind of like that. You know what I mean?
John Hockenberry is our guest. Is one of your aims to attract, John, a more diverse audience, one you might not normally associate with public radio?
Well, part of the ideas thing is it only works if you're listening to ideas from everybody. Mm-hmm. If you're constantly, you know, listening to the same group of people, the ideas are going to sound the same over and over again. And I think this is a real problem on cable television. It's the same all the time. And I think, you know, whether it's Rachel Maddow or Chris Matthews, you know, they're coming at it from a fairly selective perspective. And,
predictable.
You know, the shows tend to say they're predictable and they sound the same. And, you know, I like Rachel, and I think Chris has some things to contribute. But if you listen to them over a long haul, you're going to hear the same things over and over again. To keep from doing that, we have to embrace voices that you're not going to hear anywhere else. And so we have an aggressive reach into the South Asian community here in New York, an aggressive reach into the African-American community in Detroit and in New York, for that matter, and around the United States. We're very interested in youth culture. Even me, you know, in my mid-50s, but I got two teenage daughters. Believe me, you got to understand what's going on in youth culture to be in any way affluent in what's going on in American culture right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whether I'm a dad of two teenagers or just trying to do a successful radio show, it's absolutely essential to keep those voices, Latino voices that we have around the country. You know, this is something we cultivate and curate very, very seriously.
Hey, how much of a good interview depends on the guest and how much depends on the host?
Boy, that's a really good question. You know, I think it's a sliding scale. It depends on who you're dealing with. I think you've got to have a really full toolkit as an interviewer. And that both is – and there's two drawers to that toolkit. The top drawer are the listening tools. The bottom drawer are the kind of how do you drive the interview?
Mm-hmm.
And you got to have a lot of tools in both drawers to make it work. And you've got to listen to people to let them tell their story. And then, you know, you want to use the other set of tools to kind of guide them. A lot of times people – and what I say in interviewing is, like, embrace the madness. So if somebody's acting strange, you want to get into that. You don't want to, like, shut that down and, oh, let's try to be more responsible. You really want to ride that interview where it wants to go.
Mm-hmm.
And if sometimes that takes you into kind of a scary place, I think audiences really love that. So if somebody's talking in a really boring way, you kind of want to understand why. And if you embrace it, sometimes really interesting stuff comes out. Then, of course, you know, you want to have the sense to get out of the way when you've got somebody fabulous. And I think that's, you know, it's being able to do that in real time and to adjust and to throw your sort of game plan out the window when somebody mm-hmm. starts talking in a way that's amazing and wonderful, because conversations are about spontaneity, that's for sure.
Well, help a veteran talk show host here. How do you embrace a guest who is a little on the boring side, who isn't giving you a lot of energy and a lot of oomph?
Well, what you can do, there's two tools that I use. One is you try to draw them out and get sort of the personal stuff behind it. And you sort of say to them, you know, I hear all that, what you're saying. I mean, I get the blahdy, 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 blahdy. But this isn't how you talk to your wife about this, right?
You hope not.
And then they'll sometimes go, You know, you're right. Yeah, you're totally right. That's one way of doing it. And it's kind of like guilt tripping them into like drop the veil, which is probably something they've been told that morning by everyone in their family. Now, don't be boring on the radio, you know. And then when you just prod them a little bit, all of a sudden they're hearing all those conversations. And they go, "Yeah, right." Yeah. Now, the other thing you can do is to sort of be sensitive to the listener. The listener will be hearing somebody who sounds a little dry.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you do is you kind of create yourself as being in a predicament. What you'll do is you're like, you say to the guy or the woman, you know, "I'm sorry, this is really sounding like so dry. I mean, you got to give me more than this." And mm-hmm. and basically you're anticipating that the listeners out there are going, "Geez, this guy's dead," or "this person is dead." And you're basically making yourself the host in the listener's predicament. So suddenly, even if that person continues to be boring, the listener is like identifying with you as like trying to solve their problem with the guest. And so you're suddenly got about like a hero to the listeners. And often that gets people that get, you know, and you can even turn it as a positive. You can go, "I am sitting here with like Mr. Librarian of, you know, the Hittite language." And sometimes if they give you gems, even if it's in a completely boring context, you can like pull them out and go, "That's amazing. I can't believe I just learned something from the world's most boring conversation."
But aren't you really putting people on the spot then? Because a lot of folks who come in here are sort of nervous and they haven't done a lot of radio, and you're trying to sort of get them through the half hour or whatever the segment time is. And aren't you sort of just shaming them publicly by sort of acknowledging it's as bad as it sounds like?
What I think what you want to do, and the most amazing tool that you have, is to be sympathetic and mm-hmm. to get that person on. You know, you want that person to be going, "It's you and me together. And, you know, I understand that you're kind of, you know, dry, and you got to understand that I'm kind of Mr. Radio Host, and together we're going to get through this." And I think, you know, the most important tool that you have is to relax that person, to make them understand that they're not in a threatening place, but that they do have to be honest, you know, that they can't just be selling.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think people understand that. You're not guilt tripping them. You're basically saying, "Come on, you know, I'm just a person. I'm not, you know, at the Walmart of ideas here. You know, we're spending our time with you, so it's really up to you to tell us something, to teach us something." And that's true whether you're talking to Newt Gingrich or if it's just somebody who's never done radio before. I think you want to give them a sense of responsibility, remind them of their sense of responsibility, as is the case in any conversation. You know, be truthful, be authentic, bring something to the table. I think that's important. And people get that. That's not about guilt-tripping them. That's not about making them feel bad.
Do you have a list, John, of all-time great interviews that you trot out for guys like me who ask questions like that? I mean, you've interviewed so many folks over the years. Who are your three or four all-time, all-star Grand Slammers?
I mean, I always have two answers to this question. And answer number one is the last interview I did, because I think you want to be fresh.
No, seriously, you
want to be fresh. You want to look at every single interview as a challenge. There's no like special star. I mean, sure, I'd love to interview Chelsea Clinton, okay, mm-hmm. when he was alive. I would have loved to interview Johnny Carson.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of people who I would love to be in the presence of, you know, because of my own personal narrative. But ultimately, you know, anything can be a fantastic interview. And so the last one I did is my favorite, you know, if it was successful. And, you know, I'll have great experiences on the show, you know, 4, 5, 6, 10 times a week. And that's, I think, because this stuff works. People do want to talk and they do want to be on the air. But my real answer is a guy named Saul Lubroff in Iowa, who I interviewed a long time ago on a piece that was on a Weekend Edition.
Who's Saul Lubroff?
I was filling in for Scott Simon. Saul Lubroff is a saxophonist in Iowa who you've never heard of. But when I profiled him, he was a radio DJ for a college radio station at the University of Iowa, and he had Tourette syndrome.
Mm.
And the kind of Tourette syndrome he had was that he uncontrollably shouted the most obscene, disgusting things.
Sure.
And there's a lot of people with Tourette's that don't do that. He did that. And I went down there and I interviewed him. And when he was on the air, he kept it in control. And when he was off the air, He said the most outrageous stuff, but he sit there, and I did an interview with him, and I put it into a piece, and we had terrible difficulty cutting it so that it could actually air. But I just was so amazed at this guy's control. The level of control and kind of risk he took to do a stupid weather break on the College Station in Iowa City, Iowa. I have never met anyone who physically demonstrated both reverence and power for radio. And the revelation was, as I spent some time with him, I realized that, man, Howard Stern goes out of his way to come right up to the line and, you know, occasionally cross it. Mm-hmm. Not anymore because he's on satellite radio. But Howard Stern would do everything he could to come up to the line of obscenity, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he would always get in trouble and maybe lose his job. And for doing that, he got paid, you know, $20 million a year, right, as a shock jock. The idea was to tease the edge of the envelope of that obscenity. Saul Lubaroff couldn't help himself. He was doing everything he could to restrain himself from exactly the kinds of things that Howard Stern would get paid extra to come close to and not say. Howard Stern gets paid $20 million. Saul Lubaroff, you know, maybe minimum wage, and he could never hold a job down because after a while the PDs got tired of him. He's now a very successful jazz saxophonist in the Iowa area, and his Tourette's is much more under control. But the power of somebody whose inner story tells a lesson that is hugely profound, and that comes out over the course of just casually getting to know them, that is the powerful interview. And if you can learn something like that and get that kind of an insight from just talking to somebody who's a nobody, that's the best thing.
John Hockenberry speaks at noon Friday at an awards banquet for the whole person, people with disabilities leading independent lives. More information about that event on our website, kcur.org. You know, as I just mentioned, John, you're coming to Kansas City this week to speak to the whole person. People will wonder, how did you do your international reporting in all those war zones for so many years in a wheelchair, John? How did you pull that off?
Well, you know, I didn't have a choice, so that was the way it was going to be. And I think, you know, it's interesting just mentioning Saul Lubaroff, because here's a person with a disability who has an amazing story to tell. I think in my case, it was both a determination to show up and be a reporter like everyone else, but also understanding that if you have a personal story and, you know, you interact with people around you, it makes you a better journalist because they ask you questions about you. And what I discovered as a journalist in the Middle East is that, you know, it was so easy as one of the Western journalists in places like Jerusalem or Tehran or Lebanon to just basically go with the herd and do the same story that everybody else was doing. Reuters has the same story as the New York Times, as the AP. But suddenly, if you're in a wheelchair and you can't go with the pack, and your network of sources within the society are nurses and physical therapists and prosthesis designers and craftsmen, suddenly you have a whole different window on the society. And so the stories that suddenly I was doing in the Middle East were different. The sources I had were different. The window on society was different. It immediately became something that went from, oh my gosh, there's no way I'm going to be able to do what everyone else does, to why the hell did I ever think that doing what everybody else does was going to make me successful journalism, for heaven's sakes.
Right.
So it was a great kind of little bit of wisdom at the very early age in my career. And as you know, as a journalist, I mean, you know, they run around on deadline. Wisdom is not something we associate with deadline journalists. So I was very, very fortunate to be a disabled journalist in the Middle East. And, you know, the physical answer to your question is, it's great when you're in places where they never built curbs, because then, you know, you don't have to look for the ramp. And so Somalia was pretty easy to get around in. Now, there were horrible things about Somalia, but, you know, trying to figure out where the curb cut was or the ramp was, or the door was not a problem there. And this is similarly the case in Gaza. And, you know, accessibility is a state of mind. It's not necessarily architecture and signs and parking spaces like we have in the United States. I did really well.
What did you make of Oscar Pistorius's run in the Olympics and this, you know, this controversy over whether he should have been allowed to compete in the first place or not?
See, I'm a radical on this one. I think throw out all these rules. I think performance-enhancing drugs, prosthetics, if Lance Armstrong can use, like, the most high-tech bicycle in the Tour de France and have a technological advantage using his bicycle, I mean, what is the problem? I mean, I think Oscar Pistorius is running. He's running on these prosthetics. What is this normal that supposedly enforces this idea of, you know, what athletics are supposed to be? All right, maybe if there was an amputee running event in the regular Olympics, not the Paralympics, maybe we could have a discussion about whether Pistorius has some sort of advantage. But until that happens, you can't even have that discussion.
But, you know, some countries,
Pistorius, though, can qualify. He should do it.
But some guys in some countries can't afford those super-duper bikes that you're talking about with Lance Armstrong.
Well, so all I'm saying is that the Tour de France is already a rigged game. You know, we already, in sports already, it is rigged already.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that Pistorius, that we're going to talk about advantages all of a sudden with Pistorius, for heaven's sakes? Oh, with the amputees, we're going to talk about it. We're not going to talk about it in every other aspect of sports? I mean, I don't know. It drives me a little bit crazy. I think we have this fetish about normal as though, you know, the Olympics are for Adam and Eve. And no, we're in the 21st century, and I think we have to get used to the fact that people are living with disabilities and they're going to compete with disabilities, and that's not going to be perceived as abnormal or some separate category all the time. And I say bring it on. The closer we get to leave the normal thing behind and embrace this level of physical diversity that suddenly exists because people with disabilities are living longer and with us and in our communities, I think the healthier mentally we're going to be.
Again, John.
Know, there's a great line in The Onion. Did you see when Pistorius qualified the first time?
No.
It was athletes, when he first was told he couldn't compete 4 years ago in the Beijing Games, there was the next day on The Onion, the headline was athletes angered on Pistorius' ruling and regret cutting off their own legs. Because the idea was is that Pistorius has an advantage, so all the runners would cut off their legs so they could get the same advantage.
Again, John Hockenberry speaks at noon Friday at an awards banquet for the whole person, people with disabilities leading independent lives. You can see John there. More information about that event on our website, kcur.org. John, it's been an absolute treat to have you. Thanks for taking the time.
Oh, it's great. Thanks.
You
I'll
bet.
See you
All
in Kansas
the best,
City.
John. You bet.
Go Royals.
You bet. Oh, yeah. Good luck with that. That's John Hockenberry. Again, he speaks in town at noon Friday. Coming up, another journalist who often goes against the grain, Malcolm Garcia, who had a long stint with the Kansas City Star. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR.